This is The Think Tank, talking about the major economic, political, and social issues of the week on The Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3, KTAR. Here's Dr. Mike O'Neill and Mike Russell.
All right, thanks for spending some of your Sunday with us. Hope you've had a great weekend. Let's talk about two of my favorite things. First, coffee. Second, money. All right, we welcome Susan Saladoff. She's a documentary film producer and attorney. We also have in studio Tom Rogers. He's a prominent local attorney. He's going to comment on all things relevant to the great state of AZ.
Okay, to get right into it, Hot Coffee is a documentary movie produced by our primary guest here today, and we've all heard the story, or at least we've heard the five-second Jay Leno version. That version is this. Woman spills coffee on herself, from McDonald's coffee on herself. She sues McDonald's. She collects multi-million dollar settlement. That's the five-second version. The jury heard a two-week version. They came to a different conclusion from most of us. Our guest, Susan Saladoff, can tell us here a little bit more about what actually transpired.
Hi, thanks for having me. So most people think that she was driving the car, which of course she was not. But the reason why most people think that is because the media completely portrayed this case incorrectly. Jane Pauley, who was substituting for Tom Brokaw on the NBC Nightly News that night, reported to the world that she was driving. She was a 79-year-old mother and grandmother who had just retired from working. She was a passenger in a car that her grandson was driving. They pulled up to a drive-through in Albuquerque, New Mexico. She ordered coffee through the drive-through. They put it in a bag, and it was the old kind, the old-fashioned kind of cups, you know, the styrofoam cups with the little plastic top that you could never open the top.
Oh, I know those. Yeah, right.
And the grandson pulled into a parking spot. They parked the car. It was an old car. This happened in 1992, so it wasn't like the kind of cup holders we have today. And there were no flat surfaces, so she placed the cup and held it on the seat in between her legs to try to steady it so that she could open it and put the cream and sugar in. And when she couldn't get that little triangular thing off, she pulled the actual top off, and the cup literally collapsed, and the coffee pooled in her crotch. And the coffee was between 180 and 190 degrees Fahrenheit, which McDonald's knew would cause third-degree burns, which are the worst kinds of burns that you can get, within 3 to 7 seconds. And so this coffee pooled in her crotch. She had on underwear, nylons, and a sweatsuit. She couldn't get out fast enough to prevent her from getting burned, and that's really the issue about hot liquids. The hotter it is, the less time you have to get out of it. So that it won't burn you. But she tried to get out of it, and she suffered third-degree burns, which required skin grafting and surgery. She was in the hospital for 8 days and had to literally have skin taken from her thighs and sewn into her private parts. She was incapacitated for almost 2 years. And what she did was she contacted McDonald's and said, all I want you to do is pay the difference between what my medical bills are and what Medicare paid, and which was about $10,000 at the time. McDonald's offered her $800, never offered her another penny. And she went to trial, and the jury, by the way, was a unanimous jury. They found her 20% at fault because she did spill the coffee, but they found McDonald's 80% at fault because McDonald's had paid out over 800 times for other people who had been burned by scalding coffee, and they knew that it was causing these kinds of burns, and yet they refused to change the temperature or do anything about it. And so the jury got so angry, they awarded her literally 2 days of coffee sales for McDonald's. So it sounds like a crazy amount of money, but it was only 2 days of coffee sales, which was $2 million. And then the judge, in fact, reduced the amount to $480,000, and then they wound up settling for an undisclosed amount afterwards. And so, she was subject to a gag order. Because when you settle these types of cases, usually the company requires that the person who gets any money signs a gag order so that they won't be able to speak about it, whereas the company doesn't have that same kind of gag order. So there was all this false information that went out to the world, and it became a joke. You know, it was on Jay Leno, and Jerry Seinfeld did a whole episode on it. And so those are the real facts. And when most people see the movie Hot Coffee and they see the burns and they see what really happened, they're appalled, and they think, yes, this was a legitimate legitimate case.
Well, Susan, I'll ask you a question here. Is this a temperature of coffee issue, or is this your crotch is not a coffee holder issue? Because I think that's why people made it a joke with Seinfeld and with Jay Leno, was because we all should know that no, if it's 180 to 190 degrees or if it's 150 degrees, the crotch is no spot for your coffee.
Yeah, but see, there's a big difference between what you just said, 150 degrees and 180 degrees. Most of our coffee makers, and when you go to a coffee shop or somewhere, the coffee that you get is between 145 and 160 degrees. Like 160 is really, really hot. And what happens is, you know, we all spill things on ourselves. We have all spilled coffee, right?
Right.
But when you spill coffee on yourself and it's between 145 and 160 degrees, you have 20, 30, 40 seconds to get out of it so that you don't get burned. But at 180 to 190 degrees, which is the temperature that they were holding the coffee at, it was policy. It wasn't like this particular McDonald's was doing this. They were doing it all over, you know, all the McDonald's were doing this because that was their policy. They knew, their quality assurance representative testified at trial that they knew that people would get burned, third-degree burns, which, as I said, are the worst kinds of burns you can have, within 3 to 7 seconds. You don't have time to get out of that hot liquid, and they're selling it through the drive-thru. So when people are buying coffee through the drive-thru, even though this particular person wasn't driving and wasn't moving even at the time, but most people are going to drink their coffee as they're moving, so the likelihood is that they will spill it. And the reason that the jury got so angry was because McDonald's knew it was doing this and continued to sell coffee at the temperature that they knew would cause these kinds of burns. I mean, God forbid it was a child or a little baby that got these burns on them. I mean, you saw the film, right?
I saw the film, and one thing I would like you to do, if you would, because people just hear the numbers, some of that was what they call compensatory damages, and other was called punitive damage. Would you explain what the difference is between those two are and how that played here?
So compensatory damages are given for medical bills, wage loss, and for what's called pain and suffering, which is, you know, your physical pain, your emotional suffering. I mean, and this woman had these burns. I mean, literally, it tore the skin, not tore, it burned the skin through her vagina. And she had to have skin grafting, skin pulled, like, you know, taken from her thighs and sewn inside of her. And she was in the hospital for 8 days, and then she couldn't even wear pants for, like, 3 or 4 months. She couldn't put anything on, and then was incapacitated for, like, 2 years. So there's an amount of money that the jury would award for the medical bills, any wage loss. She had just retired, so there was no wage loss, but for the pain and suffering. But then there's an additional amount of money that in some states, and this is state by state, actually, it's called punitive damages. And punitive damages are given to punish a defendant, a wrongdoer, when they either intentionally do something to harm someone or they are reckless in what they do. And so in this case, the punitive damage award that was given against McDonald's was this 2 days of coffee sales. And the jury awarded punitive damages because of the knowledge that McDonald's had that their coffee was causing these kinds of burns over and over and over again, and refused to do anything about it. In fact, they were very callous about it, and that's why the jury got so angry. And by the way, the jury, you know, it was unanimous. They came into the jury box and said, McDonald's is at fault. And again, they didn't find them all at fault. They found her partially at fault, 20%.
Right, there was some culpability there, right?
They
said, this is your skin in the game, no pun intended, and here's mm-hmm. McDonald's, which I think a lot of people would agree that that's fair. We're going to come back to that right after a break, but we are against a break right here. More with Susan Saladoff when we come back. You're on the Think Tank with News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
You're listening to the Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
We are here on the Think Tank with Susan Saladoff, who is the executive producer of the movie Hot Coffee. And we were talking about the famous McDonald's coffee case and a personal observation, having just watched the movie over this weekend. I want to tell you what I saw in terms of the physical imagery of the injury was nothing like what I expected. It did not resemble what I'd call a coffee burn. It was a lot closer to what one might envision if you saw the insides of your thighs cut out with a knife. It was pretty gruesome stuff. So Let me ask you, Susan, to if you could put the film in context, and I know you actually, the McDonald's case was really only one of four examples that you used. If you could put this all in context and explain to us really what this film was really about in its broad thesis.
Yeah, thank you. The film, it represents, there are four storylines in the film, and each one is character-driven, but what they represent is how we as Americans are giving up our rights to access the courts, and how most of us don't even think about it or care about it until we need it. And why that's so important for people to understand is because we only have three branches of our government in our democracy. We have our legislative branch, our executive branch, and our courts. And most people realize that our legislative branch and our executive branch have been bought by money and power and large corporate interests that lobby and so on. But most people think our courts are independent. And what they find when they watch this film is how money and corporate interests are now affecting our court system to the point where people are really having a limited access to getting justice. And the only place where we can hold wrongdoers accountable as average citizens is in the courts. And then once the courts are taken away from us, we really lose our democracy completely. And so the film has four storylines, and each one represents a different way that that's happening. But what's ironic is that it's not that these rights are being literally taken away from us. We are voluntarily handing them over without even knowing it because of the propaganda and the information that's being fed to us that people are believing. So the McDonald's coffee case is just an example of how the media and corporate America used this case and fed us false information so that we would believe that the system was broken, that our court system wasn't working, and that it needed to be reformed or changed. And so once the public was convinced that the system was broken, like how crazy is it that a woman can win millions of dollars just by spilling coffee?
The phrase that sticks in everybody's mind that they successfully promoted is frivolous lawsuits.
Exactly. And so, well, if this could happen, we have to change the system. We have to, prevent this stuff from happening. So how did they go about doing that? Well, they tried at the federal level to put something called caps or limits on people's ability to get certain amount of damages in cases. And that was overturned by Bill Clinton, actually. It was attempted when Newt Gingrich was the Speaker of the House back in 1994, and he had his whole contract with America. But that didn't happen at the federal level, so what wound up happening is that corporate America decided, well, let's go state by state, and let's find legislators in states who would be willing to put limits on people's damages when they go into courts. And what that means is that corporations can have an unlimited – they basically are given a waiver on how much money they're going to ever be held accountable for. So they can pollute our waters. They can make products that harm us. But if there are caps on damages, it means that they'll never be held accountable for over a certain amount of money, which means that they can just – they make more money, and they just sort of factor that into the cost of their products. And so one of the storylines is what are caps on damages and what does it mean for average citizens? And then what happened was that these caps on damages statutes were starting to be challenged around the country because they were unconstitutional. And because we have something called the Seventh Amendment to the Constitution, which says we have the right to trial by jury. So then, in most of our states now, we're electing our judges. And when judges have to be elected, they have to run for office. And when they run for office, they have to raise money. So now what happened was Karl Rove, who was George Bush's lead strategist in Texas, started this down in Texas where they essentially put large amounts of money from corporations into judge races and essentially started buying Supreme Courts of states. They started buying judgeships at the state level, which means that at that point, nobody cares whether or not – corporations don't care whether or not a plaintiff gets a large verdict because it'll get overturned by the time they get up to the Supreme Court. And then the last storyline, which is the one you had mentioned before, is about Jamie Lee Jones, is that I wanted to show how this affects everyday citizens. So if you're coming to watch this movie, like how does it affect you personally? Well, one of the things that we're being asked to do now is sign away our rights through contracts, through something called mandatory arbitration. So if you buy a new car, if you have a mortgage, if you have a cell phone, if you have a credit card, essentially you are signing away, or just by using the product, using your credit card or using your cell phone, you are essentially saying, if I ever have a dispute with this company, I no longer have access to the courts. I have only access to mandatory arbitration, which means that the company that you are bringing this lawsuit against picks the decision maker, pays for the decision maker. The decision maker doesn't have to give a reason why he or she comes up with the decision. It's completely secretive, and the decision maker doesn't have to give a reason, and it's completely secretive. Oh, and there's no right to appeal.
Well, let me stop you on the one point, though. I think most people would assume that if you go to arbitrator, that's a neutral arbitrator. Isn't that arbitrator a neutral party in all of this?
No, in most of these situations, by signing these agreements, or like if you buy something online, you know, you have to check that little box, I agree to the terms and conditions before you can buy it. And they won't let, you know, when you sign those or check that little box, you're saying that whoever you are suing, they pick the decision maker and pay for the decision maker.
Okay, now I want to hear where I can see Hot Coffee, where I can get more information about Hot Coffee. I want give us your pitch for the movie, please.
Sure. Well, it's streaming on Netflix right now, so you can get it there. It's also available on iTunes. You can rent it or buy it on iTunes, Amazon, Xbox, PlayStation. It's also in many libraries at this point, and it's being shown at a lot of schools. But I would say that and also if you go to our website, which is hotcoffeethemovie.com, you can buy a DVD and you can learn more about it. There's a trailer there, and there's a lot of information. So hotcoffeethemovie.com.
What's next?
And also join our Facebook fan page, which is hotcoffeethemovie.com, or Facebook. / Hot Coffee the movie.
What's in the works? What's coming up next? What's the follow-up to the Hot Coffee movie?
Well, there's a section of the movie about a Mississippi judge named Oliver Diaz, and he was targeted for defeat by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which is the largest lobbying group for corporations in the world. And I'm taking that section of the documentary, I'm making it into a narrative film, like with actors and a script, sort of think Aaron Brockovich or The Verdict or that kind of thing.
Well, Susan Saladoff, we appreciate you joining us. Thank you so much. Best of luck with Hot Coffee, the movie. You can find it at hotcoffeethemovie.com or darn near anywhere you can get a movie. Very excited to see more about that and hear more from you. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
All right. When we come back, we've got a big hitter in the house, right? We've got a big hitter for local local. I'm sorry. I always go to politics. I don't know why. Local law right here. Next on The Think Tank.
You're listening to The Think Tank on The Voice of Arizona. News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
We want to thank our guest, Susan Saladoff, who is the producer of the movie Hot Coffee, which is available on Netflix and Amazon and every other streaming device apparently in the world. And the website, hotcoffeethemovie.com, I believe. But I know also from my own research on that, if you just Google Hot Coffee, you get the site. So that's shorter and easier. Our other guest today is prominent local attorney Tom Rogers, who has a lot of interesting perspectives on this, because I understand that in addition to being a practicing attorney, you've also served as an arbitrator, have you not?
I have. That is not a major part of my practice at all, but I have been an arbitrator.
Okay. Well, let's talk about that, because one of Susan's contentions is that arbitration, which, just to background people who don't recognize the term, is seen, I think, by many people as a very efficient alternative to a full-blown and ergo expensive court case. You go in a more, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but you go in a more informal setting, present your case, get a countercase, and get a decision. The decision, I think, is not appealable. It's quick, it's concise, and therefore seems to answer what a lot of people's objections are to the expensiveness of the legal system. Is that wrong, and is there anything else wrong with the arbitration, and how does it actually work?
As a good lawyer answer, it depends.
Okay.
The arbitration is, and very often can be, a very positive thing, which is agreed to and sought by both defense counsel and plaintiff's counsel, because, as you say, it can be quicker and can be cheaper, but not necessarily. If you're in the court system, you have a filing fee, and you have some costs associated with depositions and so forth, but it's not necessarily cheaper. If you're paying an arbitrator, I have a good friend who's an arbitrator, and at the rate of $400 an hour, he is happy to spend days and days and days with you and opposing counsel and charging both. Now, there are, but so again, it can be cheaper. It is not always cheaper. The greatest concern from the standpoint of plaintiffs and their attorneys are that there's the concept of a frequent flyer. Most companies have the corporate history and have used arbitrators for years, and they know who the ones who ruled against them. And with being very candid, while professional arbitrators will do their best to be objective, if you know that your reimbursement going forward, you're ever being used again, means that if you go against that company, you're never going to see that type of work again. It is a real concern. So that it's, again, I don't want to overstate it. Most arbitrators are very professional. They want to be fair, but that money incentive is a concern. Just like the judge who, if he has to run for re-election and knows that if he rules against this particular company in a matter, that the company could finance his opponent in the next election.
Let's put a hold on the judicial thing. We'll return to that. With respect to arbitrators, who picks the arbitrator?
It depends.
Oh, that's
good lawyer answer.
Let
me bore you if I can just for a second. Arbitration originally rose out of the collective bargaining arena. It was first brought into law so that unions representing workers, they would have knowledge of the arbitrators that were available, and the companies would have their knowledge of it, but it would be a forum where both sides knew the history of the arbitrators, and it is out of that context that the idea that there would be impartial arbitrators would be available.
That context seems to be fair. You've got an institution on one side, the company. You've got an organized group, which is a union, on the other side to represent the workers. That seems like a fair fight.
That's how it started, and that's why arbitration was favored by both plaintiffs in the labor management concept and obviously companies.
But if I have a dispute with my cell phone company, that doesn't seem so fair. I'm a one-time player.
Absolutely. You don't know who that arbitrator is, even if you're in a forum that allows you some choice. Now, again, American Arbitration Association has rules. It does not allow the company to say you will only pick this one. But it does allow the company to say we will not agree to one of the seven that's on the list and that sort of thing. So it is something that will affect you going forward, even though the company can't pick the sole one. They have a right to veto the one that they have ruled against.
In other words, you give some big company an award. You're an arbitrator, and you give a big award against some company. The fear in the back of their mind is, I may just be damaging my future business.
Again, professionally, they will do their best not to do this. I don't think they're disingenuous at all, but there is that reality. If I rule against this company, and if I've been able to have three or four arbitrations with this company in the last few years, that will be a big portion of their business.
So to say they're all bought and paid for is a broad brush. We're talking about there's bad apples in any profession, right?
Correct.
So this is definitely the minority, not the majority of arbitrators that are, you know, doing it for the dime.
Correct.
Okay.
And there's if you go back and look at the history of arbitrators, most of them will have ruled against a company some of the time. But if they're ruling against the company the majority of the time, you can guarantee that they will be struck going forward.
And they know this.
None of them are stupid.
Right. You don't get to that job being a dummy.
Seems to me.
Let's say I'm not an arbitrator, see? So you got to be intelligent.
This seems to me analogous to a lot of the discussions that we've had about medical practice. You know, doctors want to treat you and they want to treat you well, but there are also economic incentives. And under our current system, the more stuff you do, the more you get paid. It makes it easier for you to be inclined to do more stuff. And it doesn't mean that you're a bad doc or that you're dishonest, but you are aware that one type of decision or one type of practice can be tend to be a little bit more lucrative than another. So tell us about some of your experiences as an arbitrator and how that relates to what we've heard up to this point.
Well, most of my arbitrations are forced labor. Lawyers in the state of Arizona, by being members of the bar, can be selected to become arbitrators on small cases.
Jury duty.
Right. Yeah, like jury duty, exactly. Now, fortunately...
Pays better than jury duty, though, doesn't it? Come on. It's better than $8 a day.
We get, assuming the arbitration goes through, we get $75, which doesn't cost for the fee it takes to pick up the file from the court. But that's another story.
That's not per hour. That's per case.
Yeah.
Sounds a little closer to jury duty than.
You would much prefer to be a paid arbitrator, and again, getting hundreds of dollars per hour, or many arbitrators charge on a daily basis, say $2,200 for a day's arbitration. So again, they have to earn a living, and I don't begrudge that. But the arbitration, and again, the professional arbitrators, they go out of their way to be sure that they do a good job. But whatever the job is, they know that with very few exceptions, there is no review of their case. If they interpreted the law wrong, there is no review of it. And as pointed out by our earlier speaker, there is inevitably an agreement in most instances that there will be confidentiality as to the final award. As a result, if you find out that a company has done the same thing over and over again, you don't have a way to bring that to the attention of the arbitrator.
Okay, so that's one of the reasons why companies would like that. If they have a practice of habitual bad behavior, that information doesn't get out.
Well, the case that we were discussing about the spilled coffee, there had been 700 prior claims against McDonald's in the years preceding that actual lawsuit. So part of the punitive action was a jury feeling that this was excessive and they need to help put a stop to it.
All right, more with Tom. Don't call me Mr. Rogers. He's a prominent local attorney who's going to keep it right here in Arizona. I have a question when we come back, though, about the liabilities of franchisee, because you mentioned 700 times this has been brought to McDonald's, what the liability would be to McDonald's or to the franchisee. We're going to cover that next right here on The Think Tank.
You're listening to The Think Tank on The Voice of Arizona. News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
And we want to thank Susan Saladoff. She's a documentary filmmaker. She is responsible for throwing some light onto this coffee spilling in the lap of the old lady in McDonald's getting sued to craziness.
At least gave us more than a 5-second version of the story.
How about it, right?
Google Hot Coffee, you'll see references to the movie, which you can download.
Or you can go directly to hotcoffeethemovie.com. Now, joining us is Tom Rogers, local attorney. I have to ask you about franchising. I understand a little bit about the small business world here. It was brought to light that McDonald's has been accused or charged over 700 times for this hot coffee, right?
Correct.
Prior to this lawsuit. Is this a franchisee issue? Can McDonald's just say, hey, look, that guy, that's that franchisee. That's the guy that bought the McDonald's franchise for Phoenix. He's making his coffee that way. Now you're suing that guy.
The authority in order to reach a franchisor, there has to be some proof that they have control of the product and therefore that the local franchisee who's producing that product is being guided by the franchisor. And I'm sure that that was the case here. I haven't looked at the actual corporate breakdown here, but that would be a basis to do it. There are franchises where basically you're just using a name and then do whatever you want. That there could be that sort of an issue, but it wasn't in the McDonald's case. You will cook the burger the way McDonald's tells you to cook it,
right?
And that's why all the fries are going to be the same in every franchisee.
That's what you buy when you go to McDonald's. You walk in the store, you know exactly what you're going to get. There's no local discretion in how to do it.
That's right. You're going to eat delicious French fries. Oh, they're so good.
Okay, Tom, we brought you in really as a local expert here, and there's two areas that I want to go into. I want to talk about judicial elections, but before that, I want to talk about things like caps on damages, which has been one of the things that played in the movie and some of the segments we didn't talk about, where some states have caps on damages. Are there limits on damages in Arizona? And if not, why not?
Because of the founders of our Constitution, when we became a state, the Constitution itself prohibits the legislature from enacting any caps on damages. People forget that at the time Arizona was formed,
liberal, radical, progressive, frontier state at the time.
Pro-labor.
Yikes. We were blue.
We were blue.
we were born blue.
We were deep blue. Wow. In fact, so blue that some of the provisions they wanted in the Arizona Constitution, the U.S. Congress wouldn't go along with them, and we were delayed in our statehood for a year.
That was the president. The president would not allow us to become a state because we had the recall of judges, which he thought was absolutely un-American, if not un-Arizonan. But that was an early history. Starting in the 40s, when Arizona became a right-to-work state, that was passed as the Veterans Rights Law at a time when, after World War II, if you put the name veterans on anything,
you could pass anything.
You know, you would pass it. So Arizona became a right-to-work state. Again, they're not a minority in that regard today, but that was when the formal assault started. If you are talking from the standpoint of workers' rights. And I do primarily employment law, so that's my focus. But then you've seen the corporate interests, the Chamber of Commerce and so forth, since try and limit lawsuits.
But they have to deal with this pesky Constitution, which says no limits.
And that's why you...
Which does not exist in many or most other states.
Correct. And you've seen that here we've had recently referendums. The legislature will send out to the voters a chance to amend the Constitution. Or you'll see an initiative where you can have individuals circulate petitions and bring it. That's how we got medical marijuana. That's how we got our recent minimum wage law. That allows to increase minimum wage for people who work here. So those situations try. At least two times since the mid-80s, there have been attempts to pass an initiative or a referendum that would amend the Constitution and take away those rights. The voters have not gone along on either occasion. There are things that the legislature has done in lieu of that, though, to make it harder for plaintiffs to succeed in litigation.
What have they done?
They've put procedural requirements when you're trying to bring certain actions. Like for a while, in order to bring an action for malpractice, you had to go through a panel, very, very extensive. They've limited testimony and other things by changing the laws that would affect the rights of individuals to pursue with their case.
I think the other thing in terms of limiting damages that escapes a lot of people is that a judge can issue an award with a number on it. The first review is the trying judge, who frequently does and did in this case radically reduce that number.
Right.
But the headline number is the initial number.
Yeah, the headline number is in the millions. The judge, when he was through, said, 400, I think the information I have was like $480,000, which then they settled subsequent to that regard. But it wasn't $1 million verdict. Mm-hmm.
The jury found that the
award was not. And if you, again, in light of the burns and
it probably wouldn't have got at $480,000, it probably wouldn't have gotten the same degree of publicity.
No, it wouldn't have. And again, it's intentional. I mean, let's face it. If you're trying to oppose large jury awards, the more you can get them away from juries, that will benefit.
You know, the one thing I wanted to ask this guest about, the prior guest that I didn't. I look at this whole story and I said, this seems to me.
The story of the coffee spilling at McDonald's. Yes.
Brilliant execution, I think, of a public relations campaign. I mean, the question is, how did this story get to be the punchline in every stand-up comic on late night TV? I wonder how that got there.
Well,
did they all come up with it?
I couldn't credit. I don't think you could credit public relations for this. I think we all kind of roll the eyes and think, coffee crotch, not a good idea.
Sure.
This
sure.
is not a good idea. She doesn't deserve the millions that were awarded to her. Everyone started spilling coffee
but
on their
lap. The best public relations millions. Campaign of all is always the ones with no fingerprints on it. You
it's
know.
Good call,
so
right?
The question, yeah. I don't know. I'm not saying, but I wonder if somebody sent a memo saying here's a funny thing you might want to pick up on.
Oh, I'm sure that it was a press release that went probably the first viral thing we saw back in the day.
And if that was done, it was absolutely brilliant.
I would say.
Because it worked. Because nobody talked about how they got the information. They talked about the story. You know. We've talked about, okay, so there's no formal caps on damages in Arizona owing to our history, basically, and what the state
legislative
was
and the constitutional history. Yeah,
there have been attempts to do get at the same kind of thing, but within the confines of the constitutional restriction. How about our judges? How do we get our judges here?
If you're blessed to live in one of three counties, we have a thing called a judicial selection panel that tries to weed out and the applicants for judicial nominations.
State bar, right? With a public.
It's a judicial commission that has lawyers and lay people on it that recommend to the governor potential candidates that have gone through this cycle. As I say, we're blessed to be in one of three states, one of three counties. The rest of
those
the state...
And those are the big counties.
They're the big counties.
Maricopa, Pima, Pinal.
Correct. And Pinal just recently.
Because they passed a certain threshold. I believe the constitutional provision says counties over a certain population, maybe a half million
or
something.
Yeah, I think it's Pinal like 350,000, something like
Pinal
that.
Pinal just crossed that.
And so you have judicial selection that is done by merit. Merit selection the strongest advocate I think of is former Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. And if you talk to people that have practiced in both systems, the quality of the judges are greatly superior. I think if you ask most lawyers that practice law in the two different versions. But in the rest of the state, they are elected. And again, it is a lot of fun to fly into Yuma to be in a case where you know the judge is sitting on a case, and you know one of his largest contributors in his last election was the company that you are now trying to sue. So again, I think if you look at it, not that the voters do not always make good choices, you can comment on other shows about the quality of our legislature.
I want to know how the committee is selected. For those that have, are they elected or are they selected by peers?
There is all sorts of information I should have brought if I'd have known I've gotten this question. The Judicial Selection Committee, it is a process. It is in statute. And I that would be a good show
for
you to
have in the
future.
It's not beholden to electoral politics or campaign financing or anything like that.
No.
Okay.
You're not elect. Those
right.
people I know are not elected.
Exactly. Correct. And that's important. I think that's important to clarify.
There's a professional process, and I don't pretend to know the details. Frankly, know of anybody who's ever been on one of those.
I'll recommend somebody to you for a future show.
Now, I want to get back to just swing right back to McDonald's here so we can wrap this up here. So we started with Susan Saladoff. She made a film called Hot Coffee, obviously about the McDonald's coffee scandal. By the way, I would always go to McDonald's with my grandparents. They would always take the coffee back and ask for it to be heated up. They would want it hotter than McDonald's. Maybe they had like powerful mouths. I don't know how it worked. But coming back to that, is it common to see a corporation just settle so they can not have the true amount disclosed? Because we just ran with $2 million. She was awarded $2 million. Is this common for a corporation to say, shh, we're going to give you this gag order, move on. No one will ever know.
In the last 15 years, I cannot think of a single settlement agreement that does not start with a requirement of confidentiality.
Ah.
It is a way for companies to be sure that there is no public record. In addition, as a condition for these settlement agreements, some of them are now imposing that if you do tell everything we paid you, we will claw it back. So there's a clawback provision if you violate the agreement. Because, again, would you go into an establishment if you knew that they'd injured 40 people in the previous
right.
2 years.
You wouldn't do that at
you
all.
You wouldn't do that.
Wow. Well, we want to thank you, Tom Rogers. We also want to thank Susan Saladoff of Hot Coffee. And thank you for being with us, Dr. Mike O'Neill, Mike Russell. This is The Think Tank on KTAR.